thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 66, The End of Big Search as We Know It, recorded on February 2nd, 2011. Well, welcome back to another edition of Digital Campus. I'm Mills Kelly, the host for today's podcast from the Center for History and New Media, and you can find me at edwired.org. We're joined by our regulars, Amanda French from CHNM North. Amanda, how much snow is on the ground up there at CHNM North?
Well, I was looking on some weather websites, and I think, some weather observers have been measuring it at somewhere between 13 and 14 feet on the ground. Actually, I'm just kidding, but it feels like that. It's just we're up to our kneecaps in snow, and none of the snow from a few weeks ago has melted, so it's insane.
Yes, well, maybe we can get you to CHNM South one of these days, like maybe the Miami outpost or something like that. So, Dan Cohen from dancohen.org. Dan, how are things?
Good. Good to be back on the program.
Good. And Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org. Tom, you doing all right?
Doing all right. Hi, everybody.
Well, we're about to embark on a topic that we just never anticipated in all of our predictions about the future, which just goes to show how good our predictions about the future are. But this is a, you might call it the end of Big Search as we know it, by which I mean in the last few weeks, maybe last month or two, there's been an increasing amount of commentary from around the digital spectrum about the inability of big search engines like Google and Yahoo and others to produce the kind of high-quality search results that we had come to depend on, in part because they're really being overwhelmed by spammers. Dan, what do you think about this story?
I think it's a really interesting, complex story. Let me map it out for a few minutes here for our listeners about what's going on here, because I think there's a couple of different things going on. Everyone has always tried to game Google. And really, I guess what we're talking here is about Google and the decline in the quality of their search results, which I think more and more people have been griping about later as they don't see the kind of high quality results that they were expecting on the first page. Now, of course, spammers have always tried to game the system. So when you're searching for that lovely red sofa for your living room and you type in red sofa, they have ways of making you come to their pages of lousy pages that try to sell you lousy couches. And they've used all kinds of techniques, often called search engine optimization, which has a kind of white hat version and a maybe darker black hat version where people really spam a bunch of links around to and use content farms to try to get up in the quote unquote organic search results of Google and make you click on their link first. I think what we're really talking about here, and I think what might be of interest to our audience, is that we're now seeing these problematic search results for the kinds of queries that we do in academia and that students would probably encounter more and more. The search for, let's say, a search query on the American Civil War, where there are indeed companies that are setting up kind of summary pages on topics that will end up higher up in search results than a very high quality but maybe more verbose and detailed page from a .edu domain. In fact, there are entire companies, one of which just went public, called Demand Media, that exists solely to create these kinds of sort of semi-quality pages. Okay, they are about the American Civil War. They have some basic information. And then they have ads on them that make money for Demand Media. And in fact, Demand Media will set up these pages. They actually have thousands of writers who get paid very small amounts of money, and they'll set up these pages for topics that even will make them as little as $20 or $30 or $40 over the lifetime of the web page. So they are edging into topics that are pretty marginal, but that matter for academics. And I think that's where it becomes pretty problematic. You know, there are older companies like About.com that have done this forever. But I think what happened in the past decade is that people looked at what happened to Wikipedia and Wikipedia's pages, which now come up number one for almost everything. And that's because they were naturally good for search engine optimization. They have very good URLs. So the URL is wikipedia.org/wiki/Civil War or American Civil War. The topic is right in the URL. And they're very keyword rich, and a lot of people link to Wikipedia pages. So as Wikipedia naturally rose up, but didn't take in or take advantage of the very obvious opportunity to add advertising because they wanted to stay very pure, a lot of companies said, hey, let's take the Wikipedia model, set up some basic pages, and see if we can game the system to be sort of like Wikipedia, but with a bunch of ads all over it, and make little bits of money on each one of these pages. And Demand Media, in fact, has tens of thousands of these pages, and they've moved way beyond the, you know, red sofa Fairfax, Virginia search query. They're edging into the kinds of queries that I think start to make us maybe a little bit itchy about the ways in which academic pages show up in Google search results. So I think as that's happened, I think now what people are doing is looking to other places, looking to social networks, for instance, like Facebook and Twitter, or question and answer sites like Answers.com, Yahoo Answers, and then more recently, the kind of hot website of the moment called Quora, which maybe we can discuss in a minute, to sort of ask people for more direct results. You know, hey, I'm looking for really good resources on the American Civil War, rather than searching for it in Google and getting a bunch of these sort of, you know, half-baked pages that show up very high. Maybe I'll ask my friends or I'll ask my colleagues and they'll be able to tell me where I really should go. So I think there's a battle right now over search that we're going to see. And as you said, Mills, at the beginning of the program, I think it's really maybe the beginning of the end of big Google to be able to really address our search needs in this kind of an era.
Tom, what about you? Have you run into this problem yet?
Well, I think, you know, I think we've all run into it to some extent or another. As you know, as Dan says, there are companies now that will do this, and there are the companies who are trying to do it to gain ad revenue, and then there are the companies who will do some search engine optimization for you. Let's say if you're a dentist and you want to make sure that those you know, those few bad reviews of your service get buried under a whole bunch of very positive reviews. There are companies that will do that for you as well. You know, I think that's a problem. I worry about the alternative, though, the kind of social alternative, because I think like my Twitter network would be good for answering some questions. Like I could, you know, and maybe my particular network would be better for answering academic questions. Like I could ask for, you know, oh, I can't remember the name of this this reference that I want to cite in this article. Can you guys help me with it? And I think I'd get a pretty good set of results from Twitter. You know, what I think I wouldn't maybe trust my Twitter friends with is the red sofa. You know, I think there needs to be a place for search that goes outside of your narrow social networks, where you're searching, you know, sort of outside your comfort zone. I guess that's my concern is that, you know, you choose your friends based on who you like, and they're going to spit back to you. They're like a reflection of yourself, and they're going to tend to spit back to you things that may be relevant to you, but they're never going to get you outside of your own comfort zone because you're already comfortable with them. So I guess my worry about sort of social search replacing big search is that we get ourselves stuck in these narrow boxes.
There was actually a story on NPR yesterday, which would have been February the 3rd, that I caught just a tail end of, about social networking and sort of a tribal organization of people's networks. In other words, a woman saying, you know, the people in my Twitter and Facebook universe, they're really my tribe. And so that speaks a little bit to what you're saying, Tom, is that you end up organizing yourself in a way and organizing this network, potentially organizing this network of friends or followers or whatever, so that they are your peeps and you don't have this other, this more diverse base of information.
Right. I mean, the great thing about Google is Google will take you places you wouldn't otherwise think to go, whereas I think your social networks take you to the places where maybe you expect to go, and maybe that's useful at times and reassuring at times, and quicker you find what you're actually looking for quicker, but you don't find maybe anything that you weren't expecting to get. And I think, you know, in some ways that's the soul of research, and that's what I worry about losing.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about this this morning, and I realized that I almost never do a kind of open-ended Google search anymore, or Yahoo, or any other search engine. I don't tend to just type in, you know, sort of a keyword search anymore. I have migrated to the much more specialized kind of pieces of that search. So I'm searching in, you know, Google Scholar or Google Books or Yahoo Answers or something like that. So I've kind of abandoned the main search screen altogether. I don't do the social searching the way that others do, but so I'm still using the search engines, but I'm not using them in the way that they originally were popularized. I've kind of migrated away from that. What about you, Amanda?
Oh, I don't know. There's a lot to say on this topic. I guess I would say first that I don't think social search will replace big search, because they strike me as being used for very different things. Like some of the things that Google is used for that you really couldn't do with social search. Maybe more factual information. So if I want to know what year the Civil War began, I'm probably not going to ask my social network, even if I'm a, you know, an eighth grader. I know when the Civil War began. It was 1861. But, you know, I wouldn't trust that kind of factual information from my social network, I think. You know, I would Google it and look for Wikipedia. People use Google, too. I don't know if this is really relevant, but people use Google for navigation, really. You know, tons of people will type Facebook into the Google search bar and use that way of navigating to Facebook. But if the real issue here is, you know, that search engine optimization of the black hat variety is getting so good that it's decreasing Google's efficacy, I think there's a good bit of evidence to say that is true. There was that big story in the New York Times a while ago about that guy who was running designer eyeglasses company, who claimed at least that he had found out how to game Google's algorithm by just getting everybody to spew forth online about what a terrible guy he was, which upped his ranking supposedly in Google. And Google has supposedly since adjusted their algorithm to adjust for that. But yeah, SEO is and spam, which are kind of two slightly different things, but related on a kind of a continuum, are really popular these days, and I think it may be decreasing the efficacy of search engines.
Well, and so first of all, I just to point out, we've now determined that Amanda's social network is not good for facts, and Tom's social network is not good for decorating advice. Dan, what is your social network not good for?
Yeah, this is a good question. I mean, you know, I think there are a lot of ways that you can use your social network. I mean, there are a lot of times where I'm trying to remember a website that I know I've seen kind of get tossed around in the ether, and, you know, I'm sure I can ask someone about that. Or quick technical how-tos are very handy. I still think Google is really great for very targeted searches. Like if you want to find something on a website, or you have a lot of keywords, I mean, more than just one or two, and it's not a big topic, Google is still pretty killer in those ways. I mean, pretty remarkable in the ways that it can find, you know, really interior pages into a website. You know, I guess what we're talking about here is it's that kind of initial vague prospecting mode that we sometimes have in search. And that Tom's probably right. I mean, is it dangerous then to kind of take that into your social network or take it out of a kind of more democratic or meritocratic space? But, you know, at the same time, the meritocracy, the web is really under siege by places like Demand Media or AOL, which in their recent business plan sort of secretly revealed this week, they're also planning to effectively create search engine optimized pages for thousands of topics. So I think we're going to find ourselves just, you know, with a lot of students who've kind of made their way to very low quality search results. And, you know, I kind of wonder about, and it's clearly touched a nerve in that Google responded very rapidly to these criticisms. I think probably internally they sort of knew this, that they were getting worse on certain kinds of search results. And so, you know, I think, you know, here in academia, we don't do a lot of stuff. We don't do search engine optimizations. We have lousy URLs that aren't keyword rich. We tend not to use systems that promote our materials and interlink and do all these sorts of things. So I just think we're in a difficult situation where there's really no obvious good solution. I think Amanda and I just both joined Quora. I think probably, Amanda, you were like me. I figured, well, I don't know, a lot of other people are trying it, so I should try it out. And, you know, in that, I think what their Quora is one of these question and answer websites. I don't know exactly what's new about it. I suppose what's new is that you can follow other people and see, you know, how they're answering certain questions. But you can also, in a sense, poke someone and say, hey, would you answer this specific question? And those people could be outside your social network. So I guess maybe their idea is to maybe get a more sophisticated question and answer service. But, you know, there's only so many hours in a day, and I don't want to answer a lot of questions by people. So we do need some generalized arbiter of what's good on the web. But I think Google's mixture, I think a lot of people are feeling that Google's secret sauce, which is long since gone beyond the kind of reputational analysis of linking to what by all accounts is over 50 different variables. I think they do probably need to tweak that better, or we're going to lose our kind of, bird's eye view of the web.
Amanda, I was just going to say, Amanda, have you had a chance to try Quora yet?
I literally was on it for a couple of minutes. I read an article about it, and I created an account. I haven't actually tried it. It strikes me that it's kind of it's specializing a function that a whole lot of sites have had. I mean, for instance, there's DH questions and answers, which is a quite active forum for people just to, you know, post and answer questions about digital humanities. And because people are very involved in that community, they'll take the time to answer the questions. And then, you know, it creates a kind of a relatively permanent record so that you can go there and look for things as well. You know that if you have a question, there might be an answer there already. So Quora strikes me as that, but LinkedIn has that service too, and you can just use Facebook and Twitter for that. But I guess again, the supposed benefit of it is that you could ask, Barack Obama what he thinks about something, and at least in theory, he might answer you back.
I mean, it seems to me that this is like a theme that we always come back to in dealing with the web, and that, you know, there's this tension between openness, which is, you know, something that's more open, which is great, and it's free, and it's diverse, but it's, you know, a little scary, not always reliable, kind of chaotic, and something that's more closed, but it's not as rich, it has sort of artificial barriers to entry. You're further away. It takes more clicks to get to. I mean, I went to Quora because I had read about it and I kind of didn't get it. So I was like, well, I'll just go to the site. I went to the site, and like the first thing is, it's like it's just a blank page with create an account. And then I looked at that and I was like, I don't need another password, and I left. The beauty of Google is you go to Google, it's a search box, and you type something in and you get a whole bunch of stuff. But, you know, the cost of that kind of openness, that ease of access is, chaos. And there's a certain measure of chaos and unreliability there. And I think, you know, you kind of live with that when you venture onto the web. So, I, you know, and we deal with this in, you know, we deal with this with with all kinds of topics. We deal with this with, for instance, you know, crowdsourcing transcription. Well, you know, you get the benefit of lots of people's of input, but you also deal with the problem of quality control. So, you know, it also raises that question again.
We'll say about Quora too that it offers you the ability to log in with either Facebook or Twitter. And so I gave it access to my Twitter account. And I did notice once I had logged in, okay, a bunch of people that I know were already on Quora, and it seemed to, it had these topics in it already that clearly it had kind of extrapolated from the people I know who were already using Quora that were actually relevant to some things that I was interested in. I don't want to, I'm still not that impressed with it, but again, this is based on 2 minutes of playing with it, but I was impressed by how accurate it was at predicting things that I might potentially want to ask questions about.
Yeah, well, I guess it was Tuesday. I had one of those unsettling moments as a history teacher. I was walking to the car at the end of the day, and there were two students walking along in front of me, and one of them said, "Boy, you know, college is just, it's getting so much easier than it was like for our parents, because now if you want to know anything, you just type it into Google and there it is." And I, you know, it's sort of one of those head banging things where you kind of bonk on your own head or you bonk the student on the head and say, no. But one of the things I've noticed related to something that Dan said a few minutes ago is about these sort of okay content sites like about.com where the information is, you know, sort of okay. I have seen about.com and eHow starting to show up in footnotes in papers with much more regularity now. It used to be that students understood that those were to be avoided in some way, and in part because I think the content on those sites was not sort of okay. It just wasn't all that great when it came to the sorts of things we care about. And now, as it's gotten okay-ish, then they think, oh, well, that's reasonable. I'll go ahead and cite that, because they want to be sure and cite it because they don't want to be accused of plagiarism. And so we actually, in my class last semester, spent with about half a dozen students, I spent after class one day about, I don't know, 15 minutes talking about, you know, should we be using about.com, in an attempt to convince them no was the answer to that question. And they would say, but, you know, what one of the students said, but it's the facts are there, aren't they, Dr. Kelly? And I said, well, sort of. You know, it's not so clear that they are. And who wrote that 4-paragraph or 5-paragraph thing about the outbreak of the American Civil War? Where did that come from? And, you know, the answer to some of that has been, well, it's just pulled straight out of Wikipedia. And so the task I gave them was to take the piece that they had cited in their paper and do a literal search and look for that exact same sentence across websites. And what they found was that content was proliferating or had already proliferated. And so they found it on about.com, but it was showing up in a whole bunch of other places. And that, at least, I think was a very useful lesson for them, because it gave them a little bit of pause about whether or not this was good or not. Because about.com has this whole structure that makes it look pretty reasonable and authoritative, where some of the other sites that the same content was showing up were clearly just some part of a content farming strategy.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was actually going to say that same thing about Dan's very good point about these kind of middle brow information sites, because it seems to me like they've been showing up in my search results a lot more lately. I've been noticing particularly eHow keeps coming up.
Yeah, eHow. Lots of eHow.
Yeah.
Well, and I had never heard of the site until it showed up in a couple of footnotes.
Well, I believe that's Demand Media. So they're the ones that are paying people $10, $15 to write an article, and they're very savvy about getting their stuff into search results. And all they have to get is, you know, $11 or $16, and they've made a dollar, you know. And you just multiply that by tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of pages.
Well,
it's interesting to compare those sites, too, to Wikipedia, because I would actually defend Wikipedia against about.com and eHow.
Sure.
You know, in all kinds of ways. And even though what's funny on those sites is that usually there is a named person who has written the article, or one of them, I think, does have, you know,
about.com often has
never
a named
heard
person.
Of, you know, and you can email them or whatever, but they're not necessarily an expert on that topic. You know, and yet I really trust Wikipedia more because, number one, at least it's original content that has been multiply authored by volunteers, whereas on these middlebrow sites, they have paid someone not very much money to write this article or to, you know, copy and paste a great deal of it from Wikipedia. And that just strikes me as, you know, much worse.
Well, and here in Virginia, we've just recently been through a big hoo-ha about the problems that this can cause in a very large way, because the fourth grade history textbook that was adopted, that was written under contract with the Virginia Department of Education by someone who was not a historian but a writer, and was adopted by school districts all across the state, has now had to be pulled, including right here in Fairfax County, the largest school district in the state of Virginia. They had to pull this textbook because it turns out it contains many supposed facts which turned out to not be facts, the most glaring error being a claim that tens of thousands of slaves fought on the side of the Civil War, side of the South in the Civil War, which is complete baloney. And the author, when queried about where this information came from, it was, well, online. And so and her defense of this book was, well, I'm a well-respected writer. And so, you know, all these school districts, which had paid a lot of money for this textbook, you know, there are, I don't know, over 125 elementary schools just in Fairfax County, and multiply that by however many fourth graders there are, they bought a lot of those textbooks, and they've been pulled now, and Fairfax County is having to sort of create their own teaching materials in the middle of the school year because of this. And so it's not just our students who make these kinds of mistakes, it's people who really ought to know better. And you know, it can really blow up in the face of even things like the Virginia Department of Education. So,
yeah, you know, another vector of this is about this, quote unquote, being online is that we haven't quite identified here is that there's actually a lot of outright theft. I mean, you were talking about the proliferation of texts, you know, from about.com. But a lot of what's happened over the past few years is automated tools for scraping sites and reposting them in other places.
Right.
And probably everyone here on this podcast has had their content reproduced in other places, because there are things like one of the biggest tools that's used, and I really like this plugin, but it has very dark uses as well. But there's a plugin called Feed WordPress, where you take a WordPress installation, you install this plugin, and then you point it at any site, and it will effectively just grab all the content from that site as it's published and republish it with, again, very good URLs. It'll look really nice. And there's a lot of sites like that. I won't identify one domain, but there is a domain in Thailand that reproduces a lot of digital humanities blogs.
Yes, some of my stuff has shown up on that site too.
Yeah, I've and seen so I'll, like I'll that, often yeah. search. I'll say, oh, you know, I love that. I love Amanda's post on this topic, and I'll Google it just based on the keywords, and I'll get to this site, and I'm wondering, you know, why am I getting this site above Amanda's site or mixed in with Amanda's site? So I have that concern about, you know, citing materials on the web, these multiplications. Gosh, you'd think all the PhDs at Google could have figured this out by now, but not working.
Well, and this was the gist of some of the critique that's been emerging, is that that Google may have taken its eye off the ball when it comes to dealing with these issues, as its business has really deepened in a whole variety of areas, you know, everything from the Android market to you name it, and that their sort of central core function of search results may have become, you know, been getting a little less attention. Of course, this is all sort of like criminology from the 1980s as to what exactly is happening in Google's campus. But it'll be very interesting to see, I think, over the next, the next year or two, whether it really has been the end of, or this was a precursor of the end of Big Search as we know it. On the sort of the not critiquing Google side, but the wow, thank you Google side, have any of you looked at the new Google art that's appeared?
The Google art project?
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's really cool. I mean, I don't know if people have taken a look. I think it's just that googleartproject.org. Is it org?
No, .com.
.com,
of course. Okay. But, you know, basically they got, and actually you can see the vehicle if you pan straight down in the interface, but it's like, think about Google Street View if they drove the car up into the Uffizi, yep. or the Louvre, or the Met, and drove it around. You could actually see how they did this. They got a mobile cart, a hexagonal mobile cart that they have clearly on wheels that can spin in any direction, and they push it around these galleries, and it's got a 360-degree high-definition camera. I mean, you can even zoom into the walls and see the cracks in the walls, not just the artwork. But it's very impressive. I mean, it really gives you the feel of walking through some of the galleries. The only disappointment for me was that you couldn't see. So again, just like Street View, you can kind of, there's a little window that you can use your mouse to kind of focus on different areas. And then if you click on it, you zoom into that area. And that, instead of it being a house or a business, it's an actual painting that you can then zoom into at apparently very high resolution.
Oh, you can see the brush strokes.
Oh, yeah. But the only disappointment for me was just that some of the paintings were blocked off, at least in the museums I looked at. I guess for copyright reasons.
Yeah, I read the fact, and it said that yes, if they're blocked off, it's for copyright reasons.
Yeah, I mean, it's too bad. You know, you'd love to just be able to wander through some of these museums.
But speaking as a European historian teaching in Virginia, boy, am I happy about this, because I talk about art all the time in my classes, and I will put up a slide, but it's really different to show the art as it's displayed rather than just a slide of the actual work. And you know, they really are two different things. And so to be able to, you know, now send students to the gallery without requiring them to buy a plane ticket or just look at the, you know, an individual slide of the work, I think it's going to be, you know, an order of magnitude richer for them in looking at this. So I would say thank you, Google.
I think there's not a lot to be bad to be said about this. I mean, the images are just striking and the quality is amazing. If I was going to have one criticism, actually, Mills, I would disagree with you a little bit in that I actually think one of the problems is the fact that it's so clearly and perfectly replicates the experience of going to the museum. And that, like, it seems like the digital, like, if you're going to do a digital art project with Google's resources and to kind of recreate this artificial space of the museum, where the only paintings that are on display are the ones that they've got room for on the walls of the galleries, and that they're laid out in this kind of, I mean, museums are great, I've worked in museums, I love museums, but they're artificial spaces, and they have constraints placed on the curators and constraints placed on the artworks that determined by the physical space. And you know, the stores contain so many more works, and the paintings could be arranged in so many other ways. And in fact, the paintings, you know, the museum for us is kind of the context in which these things live. But certainly the museum wasn't the context in which most of these paintings were created. These things weren't, you know, for the most part, maybe 20th century art. But before that, these things weren't made to be hung in a museum. They were made to be enjoyed in homes. They're in churches and other places. And so I feel like it kind of like reifies this necessary but definitely artificial space of the museum in a way that, you know, that the digital technology, you know, could be used to liberate us from that artificial space. And so that I guess would be my only critique here, that it just doesn't take advantage of the technology in the way that I think would be a much more exciting way to take advantage of it, which would be to imagine a new kind of gallery space for the web.
I actually wondered whether they, you know, what they're going to do if the museum ever rearranges things. Are they going to bring the cart back in and redo it the way they do for Google Street?
Well, and they do. Museums rearrange all the time, because the last time I was at the Art Institute of Chicago, Warhol's Mal was in storage, and I was not so happy about that. And when I asked a security guard where it had gone, she said, "Oh, the director is not a big fan of that work." And I thought, yes, but I'm a big fan of the work, and I just paid $12 to get in. So, you know, we've at CHNM, we've kicked around for years the idea of creating sort of a virtual space, and then all of the, you know, modeled on the exact physical dimensions of a gallery, and then here's the catalog of art owned by that gallery. Now make your own just make your own presentation of that work from the entire store, you know, digital storage of that gallery's holdings, and let the students do that. Because I, like, when I take them to the National Gallery of Art, we talk about what Tom was just saying, which is that the gallery, the placement of the work, the choices of the works, the placement of the work, is really an argument that the curators are making. And so I ask my students, you know, what is that argument that they're making? And so at least we could do a little bit of
right.
that with
and
with,
if right if and if and if you know, at the very least, if you're not going to, you know, sort of blow up the gallery and say, let's do something completely different, if you're going to recreate the space of the gallery and that's what you're going for, at least have some context. At least say, like, you know, this is the gallery, how it exists now. These are the reasons we put things here the way we have. You know, this is all constructed. And none of that's there. And that I think is the only thing that's something where, like, Google does a great job with these kinds of projects. But that's where I feel like they don't do what a scholar would do. You know, a scholar would interrogate the gallery itself and the placement of the works and the choices that the curators made. And Google, I think, you know, does, you know, a stunning job with the images, and then leaves it there.
See, this gives me great hope for the future of my profession, because as long as Google's not doing what I do, then I think I'm safe. Guys, thanks so much for another entertaining discussion of things digital humanities. Thanks to everyone who's listening today, and we will see you on the next edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself. Thank you.